News Radio 1180 WHAM proudly welcomes you to America's longest running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show at 222-1180, star 1180, a free call for Verizon Wireless subscribers, or the One Communications line at 1-800-295-1180. Now alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on 50,000 watt 1180 WHAM.
Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Sunday, the 1st of June, Anno Domini 2008, and you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Wright.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And at 7 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. As you can tell, Dave Enright is missing in action. I'm sure he's somewhere doing something. There you are. That's all you're going to get from me really right now.
Everybody's got to be somewhere.
Everybody's got to be somewhere, and most of them are Dave being somewhere else. Here's a good one. Imagine getting an email from a friend or family member with the following subject line. It's important you get back to me today. CNET is reporting a number of Hotmail users who have recently gotten locked out of their accounts. In one case, someone who had hacked into an account sent a desperate-sounding email asking for money under the account holder's name. Microsoft has no direct comment. Body of one of the emails read, I am in a hurry writing this email. I have a trip to Oxford, United Kingdom, for an urgent event. Unfortunately for me, all my money got stolen at the hotel where I lodged from the attack of some armed robbers. And since then, I've been without money. I'm even owing the hotel here, so I only have access to emails. My mobile phone can't work here, so I did not bring it along. Please, can you lend me $1,500 so I can return back and settle the hotel bills? I would return it back to you as soon as I get home. I am so confused right now. You can have it sent through Western Union. The owner of that particular Hotmail account was confirmed to be at home and quite safe. If a customer at any time suspects their account has been accessed by an unauthorized party, they should make contact with our customer support team, a Microsoft spokes individual said. That's exactly what a second locked out Hotmail user did early in May. Microsoft support staff responded with the following message. Thank you for your message to MSN and Windows Live Privacy. I understand you're having difficulties accessing your MSN Hotmail account because you believe someone has gained unauthorized access to your account. For assistance with this issue, please contact the MSN support staff using the following form. The message is signed by someone named Raktim, I don't know, from MSN and Windows Live Privacy. After filling out the form, several weeks passed, and the Hotmail account holder said he has still received no further response from Microsoft. Microsoft is committed to helping customers have a safe, secure, and positive online experience, a company spokes individual said on Thursday. In the case of the first email, Microsoft worked with the owner to restore her access. In the case of the second, it's still pending. As always, we reiterate our general guidance to customers to help protect themselves and their accounts by exercising extreme caution when opening unsolicited attachments, without addressing what might have occurred regarding the second person's account, Microsoft appears to be blaming the user. If you had used more caution, you probably wouldn't be in this situation. Now, that's true. Actually.
And completely unhelpful.
It's good to know that if you call Microsoft for support, they will blame you first.
Of course, it can't be their software.
No, it can't. Well, in fact, it's true. It is your fault. But that doesn't help you get back online. I believe that it's time to stop laying blame and start finding solutions.
I don't know if you'd want to get back online with that email address if it's been compromised.
Well...
But people are so attached to their email addresses.
People are attached to their email addresses, but your email address says a lot about you. And Hotmail doesn't present a really professional image.
Yeah.
You know, for users. It just simply doesn't.
You're right.
And how bad the grammar was in the message, you probably know how your real friends and relatives type.
Right.
And you know they misspell some words, and you know they have bad grammar, but you're used to their style.
Right.
See, I'm trying to. This is obviously a bad English translation of some
a badly
other,
English translation.
Yeah.
Right.
You see, now people know
I'm
like that. Yeah.
Wow. This is badly English.
Yes. It is.
Thank me.
There we go. Completely correct information.
But you know it's authentic.
Right.
Yeah.
Syntactically inaccurate, semantically correct. Our first caller today is Jeff from North Rose, New York. Welcome, Jeff. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm in the process of unloading three decent-sized Mac 9600 and one old Power Computing computer on eBay. In the event that that doesn't pan out, is there any way of disposing of these things and making a few bucks on them, or I should be able to take them to some sort of disposal dealer?
Well, that's two different questions.
Yeah. Disposing is easy. Making money in that disposal is hard.
Yeah. The usual joke is sit them out in front of your house and they'll be gone in an hour. But computers and electronic equipment, TVs, radios, things like that, are filled with hazardous materials, lead and cadmium tin, what are the stuff inside
all
the solder,
all
kinds of stuff. So you can't just throw it in your garbage. So most of the time your local garbage company will have some sort of hazardous waste, refuse collection, procedures, whatever. Or there are collection companies, regional computer recycling, rochestercomputers.com. They have an office in Victor and one downtown, and they will take the computer, strip the components. A lot of times they'll you get a pallet full of computers and get two or three to work out of it, and then they'll try to sell it themselves. But you're going the right way with eBay. You might even try Craigslist. The neat thing with Craigslist is that it's all local stuff, so people don't necessarily pay shipping. You try to meet up somewhere, and then you can look at it before you buy it.
I forgot about Craigslist.
Yep.
All right, excellent. Well, that could be some alternative. I hated to just throw them away randomly.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
in any case, erase your hard drive, do some sort of zero format. We've heard lots of horror stories about people buying used equipment or even broken computers on eBay and whatnot, and recovering all the data off the hard drive.
Right. I've already done all that and just to make sure that they work. I'm just hoping, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, but I don't want to get stuck.
Who's the guy running the computer museum locally?
I don't know that there is. Is there a computer museum?
There's a guy trying to start a computer museum locally.
I can't think of his name off the top of my head.
Doug, isn't it? Something? If you're listening.
Simar.
Doug Simar.
Doug Simar.
He might be interested in some of the older models as well. I'm still looking for a Lisa. I got my Apple III, although it's smoked. It's not working anymore, so I need a Lisa for my museum.
I did sell an LC on eBay.
Yeah.
99 cents, but it was better than a stick in the eye.
Yeah, I just saw a 20th anniversary Mac new in box was sold on eBay, and they did a big unboxing video. So a 10-year-old computer still new in box. So yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, it is you do have to dispose of hazardous material safely, and your garbage company will be able to do that and tell you what you need to do with it.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Right, and he was in Arcade, New York. If I recall,
and
Doug
Jeff
Simar
was in North Rose, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Arcade, that would be south of Buffalo.
Yep. Yeah.
About 40 miles.
The Attica Arcade Railroad. We go on that every year.
That's the one.
From Arcade to North Java. Or Java, sorry. For all of you living in Java.
Get it right.
right.
Yeah, to go from Java to Chile.
Yeah, right. All righty. Thank you, Jeff. I have a confession to make.
Uh-oh.
This hurts me. For those of you who came in, well, luckily it's actually fixed now. It's all good now. Last night I was in our Second Life area up on the espresso bar cleaning up, as I do every night because people leave junk around. And someone had left a tiara embedded in the platform. And as always, I right-clicked on it and said, delete it. It said, are you sure? I said, yes. And the entire platform disappeared. There was just chairs and railings and stuff hanging in midair. Apparently, I had turned on the select only my objects thing in Second Life. And therefore, when I thought I had selected the tiara, which belonged to someone else, I had in fact selected the deck, which belonged to me.
Oops.
Luckily, I didn't delete it. What I did was return it to owner, which is what I do with every thing I find. I find lots of boxes and spheres and things just lying around because people don't clean up after themselves. So I always return them to the people.
I'm not your mother.
So exactly. So I returned it, and it went back to Maboja Watkins, who was the person who actually built the thing. And he actually got on. I immediately sent him an email saying, I'm an idiot, please fix this. And he did, and it's all back now, so that's all good.
So the tiara belonged to Mbojo?
No. Oh. It wasn't a tiara. The tiara belonged to somebody else. I don't even know who. Right, I just right-click and say, return it.
Steve, do you still have yours?
Do you still have your tiara?
No,
did
unfortunately.
Did I get back to you? But the big that's not the important part. I just clean those up as a matter of fact. But the big thing was that I had accidentally sent the deck back to him. So naturally now to this morning when I did send the tiara back, I really thought, oh God, what's going to happen when I hit return? But it went back. It was that thing which went away. So I was good. And for those of you who have been IMing me fairly incessantly for the last 2 days, I do now have a hot tub. They want a hot tub.
Okay.
I went out and bought
Geek
a hot tub.
Soup? Ew.
Exactly. Exactly. I specifically want to thank Lolly, who contributed way too generously to the purchase of this hot tub. I'll be floating it up somewhere. I know it hurts, doesn't it? Geek soup is a disgusting fun. I'll be floating up. So the tough part was not buying a hot tub. The tough part was buying a hot tub with family appropriate simulations in it. I could find lots of other hot tubs.
Oh.
But it was tough to find one that was family appropriate, which I have now done. It only sits about 8-9 people, but that should be enough. I'll put it on a big platform so other people can stand around.
I still like bringing in a jar on the fireplace mantle.
Thank you. That's one of my favorite things.
I don't get your icon or your avatar in Second Life. Looks like you.
Yes, it does.
So people see what you look like.
Yes.
And they still want to be in a hot tub with you.
It's unbelievable, isn't
okay.
it? People are sick and demented. And I don't doubt that for a minute, and I know it's true. And thank God. What was that line from the very early... Oh, come on, what's it from?
From that silent movie?
No, it doesn't matter. I'll think of it later. People are sick, yeah, thank God. It'll come to me. Henry Winkler was in it, and Michael Keaton.
Oh, that was the Stephen King Night Shift.
No, your Night Shift. No. But it wasn't Stephen King's Night Shift. It was not Stephen King. I don't think.
Yeah, he had a short comedy series. Dark comedy, yeah.
Wasn't it dark?
I thought so.
It was just a comedy. Look it up. Anyway, that was so. I do have. The hot tub. I will build something for it this afternoon. We've been having fun in Second Life. We have a visitor's log that I also screwed up this morning, but I got it working. It's not 100%, but I got it working. If you go to our area, you will see that you will actually see your avatar's name pop up on the visitor list. And of course, it's very easy. Actually, to
1982, directed by Ron Howard.
Yes.
Henry Winkler, Michael Keaton, Shelley Long.
But it wasn't by Stephen King.
Nope. Stephen King did have a dark comedy short story anthology called Night Shift.
But this wasn't it. It just happens to be words put together the same way. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, Nick Francesco, and each and every one of you. It's 19 minutes after the hour, and we are Soundbites. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Wright.
And apparently I'm the only one prepared.
I saw the thing came out. I just realized my mic was in the wrong place.
And I'm Rob
ready.
Linton.
Oh, get over it. Get over yourself.
I'm professional here.
Well, listen, I was telling you a story earlier, Nick. You know, you scream my name and blare everyone's on the radio.
Yes.
The other place
he means
I work.
On the radio, ladies and gentlemen, when I go, Rob Linton, I don't just scream his name out loud during the day.
Yes, you do.
Well, yeah, okay.
I don't know when you're going to actually admit that to yourself, that you really, to yourself during the day at work, you do scream my name.
Just randomly scream your name
out
loud?
Well, no, it was funny, too, because the other place I work, I was walking into the office last week, and there's a couple of people that, you know, see me in the hall, and they'll just scream my name, and I'm like, Nick?
Yeah.
where are you? So, you know, it's just kind of fun. Apparently, it's taking off.
I'm in the process of making you world famous.
That's right. And when I see people, they scream my name. I know they listen to this show.
That's exactly it. That's good to know. And then everybody else is like, yeah, right.
Yeah, nobody else could care less. You,
a longtime listener, John, was my daughter goes to School of the Arts, and she was in a show. And his granddaughter is also in was in the same show. And he saw me there, and we chit-chatted for a while. He brought his granddaughter over and said, do you know who this is? And she went, Well, yeah, it's Amelia's dad.
There's just a certain amount
and
of people.
I said, yes, I am, and that's the most important thing I do.
There's just a certain amount of people that could really care less.
Exactly. It always leaves me humble.
Yes.
So, you know who this is? No.
No.
All right, Overstock.com has filed a lawsuit challenging a New York law that expands the state's requirements for online retailers to collect sales taxes. The Utah-based company announced Friday that it is asking the court to issue an injunction and declare the law unconstitutional. In April, our beloved Governor David Patterson signed a new law requiring companies to pay New York-based entities for directly or indirectly referring customers to their retail business to collect sales tax from New York-based customers.
And that takes effect today.
Today. And the new law goes into effect today. I was just about to read that sentence. Very good.
Thank you.
So it is an attempt to get around a 1992 U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Quill versus North Dakota case that says retailers aren't required to collect sales tax from customers who live in states where the businesses don't have a physical presence. About 2 weeks ago, Overstock announced it was cutting ties to its New York-based affiliates because of the new law. The discount online retailer said it told its more than 3,400 affiliates that as of Sunday, they would no longer be able to provide advertising for the company. I'm confident of our position in the suit, said Mark Griffin, Overstock.com general counsel in a statement. The applicable United States Supreme Court cases on the question of whether the state can collect taxes under these circumstances make it clear that New York cannot constitutionally require Overstock.com to collect those taxes. The New York State Department of Taxation and Finance, Tax Commissioner Robert Menga, and Patterson are named as defendants in the suit filed with the New York State Supreme Court. Amazon, which filed a similar suit in April, said it plans to abide by the law and begin collecting New York State sales taxes. So I'm not entirely certain what that means, except that the $4 a year I get from my Amazon Associates account will apparently now be taxed.
No, when you buy something on Amazon, they will collect New York State sales tax.
I'm an affiliate. I get a piece of that money.
Right. So you'll get less money now because they're... Well, actually, no, you may get more because they're collecting more. It depends if they give you pre-tax or post-tax kickbacks.
Right. And but whether or not I will pay taxes on that. I believe
well,
that's part
should.
Of the
you should be also. Already because that's income.
We need to get Brenna on this show.
Yeah. Yeah, you should be declaring that on your income tax.
It's like $4 a year.
Right, but it's income.
It is income. Well, I report
right.
everything.
And that goes back to the law that you're supposed to be paying sales tax, sales or use tax. New York gets around that. If you don't buy it in New York State, if you buy it out of New York State, you pay a New York State use tax on that item on your income tax forms. There's a line there where you're supposed to
and
declare it anyway.
And people wonder why we can't get more businesses to come here.
Right. Well, virtually every state does this. California is doing something similar, except instead of New York is using that affiliate to say they have a local presence. In California, they're trying to change the law on what gets taxed because they're looking at iTunes downloads and digital downloads and they're from Amazon and other companies as well. And they want to tax the digital downloads, and then they're seeing lost revenue there. And when somebody apparently noticed that there's a very large porn industry based in California.
Somebody noticed that.
And so they want to put a 25-cent tax on porn. And so some spokeswoman for the porn industry...
Attica! Right. Attica!
Some spokeswoman for the industry, you know, said, well, you impose this tax, you know, we'll be packed up and gone by the end of the week. You know, I hear that is very nice.
Yeah,
Arizona,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Arizona, yeah. So it's so every state is seeing lost revenue in internet sales taxes that people aren't paying when supposed to be already. We see it as a local retailer... it's a huge, huge competition for us. Someone says, well, I can buy that on Amazon and not pay the tax. No, they don't collect the tax for New York State. You're still supposed to pay it. And it's in the past, it's been because it's such an onerous job for a small business owner. There are 7,000 tax municipalities. Every county in the country has its own sales tax. Right now, locally, you know, we have to deal with Monroe County and Ontario County and Livingston County, Wayne County. So we already have to pay five or six different, well, we don't pay, sorry. We collect sales tax from five or six different counties. Fortunately, we only have to send one check to New York State, and theoretically, they disperse it to each county.
Right.
But we still have to know the sales tax in each of those counties. And it's kind of funny. We ask someone what county they live in, and sometimes they don't know. And we ask them what their sales tax is, and they almost always never know. But then the counties get sneaky, too. Two years ago now, Ontario County raised their sales. Anyone know Ontario County raised their sales tax? It's now 7 1/8% in Ontario County. They raised it an eighth of a percent.
There you go.
Nobody told us, and so we're filling our quarterly sales tax reports, and nothing's working right.
So we didn't get the memo.
So for the whole quarter, we've been collecting the wrong sales tax. So we had to decide if we were going to go back to every single one of our customers who bought something at our store and say, you owe us another 1/8% sales tax, or eat it. And we had to eat it.
Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah.
So now it's kind of funny when I see cash registers that aren't programmed for the new sales tax. You know, you work the tax out, and well, you're only charging 7%, supposed to be 7 1/8%. That was always the big thing about Eastview Mall. It's 1% less sales tax. So you buy a big ticket item, you can go to car dealerships in Ontario County. That 1% sales tax on a car is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
But now, on cars, you pay the tax based on where you live, not where the
right, it's
dealer
all,
is.
It's all supposed to be based on your home zip code, which is why so many stores are now asking for your zip code. And with so many computerized point of sale systems, it's not that big a deal anymore that your computer, when you type in the home zip code, pops up the sales tax of that zip code. So it's becoming less of a job for retailers because of the computerized cash
registers. So if I have a post office box in a state that doesn't collect sales tax,
if you can use that as a legal mailing address, yep.
New Hampshire comes to mind.
New Hampshire comes to mind. Interesting.
Well, so you need two. You need to get one in a state that doesn't collect sales tax, and one in another state that doesn't collect income tax.
There you go.
Florida doesn't have an income tax, right? Nevada doesn't have an income tax. They take 10%. No, 7% of all the casinos take right off the top.
Yeah, that's a place to live because they don't need your tax dollars. Right.
Florida doesn't have an income tax.
Florida taxes advertising, though.
Right. So every state has its own
complicated
difference.
Yeah.
They do have a left blinker tax.
Left blinker tax, yeah. If you leave your left blinker on too
long.
Make
a lot of money off
of
that.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. All right, our next caller. Oh, I'm going to get calls. I'm already 104. I don't care what you think. Our next caller is Doug on a cell phone. Welcome, Doug. What's your question?
Yeah, I got a quick one. I've accumulated literally hundreds of 3 1/4 floppies over the years.
Yeah.
I'm getting ready to get moved, and the problem is a lot of them probably have sensitive information. Is there any easy way to dispose of those without having to go through a lot of work?
I can think of one, and you can go to any of your local, the office supply stores. You can buy these shredders that are capable of shredding CDs.
Yeah, you need to look for a special one, not just a paper shredder, a media shredder.
They ought to be able to handle those floppies.
Easily, actually. Or if you have a friend with a wood chipper.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Or a giant magnet to scramble the data.
Not guaranteed, though.
Not guaranteed. I used to use I had a VHS tape eraser I would use.
Oh, right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's probably your best bet. If you get one of those media shredders, you could do 3.5-inch floppies, 5 1/4-inch floppies, CDs, your tie.
Okay. Although on CSI, I saw them put a CD back together.
Oh, stop it.
No, oh, no, this is real.
No,
because that was a TV show.
He's got one.
Was it NPR? A company in Germany has developed an automatic shredder reassembly thing where they just dump the shreds on the conveyor belt and a scanner and a computer scans it all, reassembles it, and gets your shredded material back. And
Doug, that's not going to happen to you.
And they're using it for law enforcement.
Yeah. Or you split the shredded bits in half and put them in two different bags and put them out 2 different weeks.
2 different weeks. Well, the one guy in response to that was saying that when they shred stuff, they put it in water. So their shredder dumps it into water, so then it becomes unmanageable pulp. Which is
for paper that
works, yeah. Which is how it ends up getting recycled back into paper again. Anyway.
I remember an episode of Superman from the '50s where he put that back.
I saw that. Yeah.
See,
in his mind, in a few seconds, just reassembles it all.
Right. Yeah, but that's probably your best bet. I did. There were years and years and years ago when we were still using 5 1/4-inch floppies. I walked into an office and somebody had taken a 5 1/4-inch floppy and stuck it to the board with a magnet and a sign on it that said, "Whose is this?" Underneath, I wrote on it, "No one's anymore."
Whose was this?
Didn't you have one of those stories from the computer store days? You sold a computer and it came back a couple days later and
the guy had bought a set of. It was D-Base. He actually bought, remember D-Base?
D-Base,
for the Osborne one. He bought a set of, not for the Osborne, because that came with it, for the Apple II. Bought a D-Base, a database system, and he drove it home. And he came back, and he said, "These discs are blank." And I said, "They came blank. It's a commercial product." And we looked at it, and indeed, it was blank. So I gave him another one off the shelf, and he came back the next day and said the same thing. I said, "What are you doing with these things? Where I've got a powerful magnet somewhere. You're putting it next to a phone?" And he stopped and he said, well, this is the very first time I ever heard of this. I have a phone in my car. It was the very, among the very first car phones, not a cell phone.
IMTS.
A car phone, and it had real ringer in it. The old style two bells with a clapper between them. And
a giant electromagnet.
The way the clapper works is a little electromagnet goes on and pulls the clapper to one bell. That electromagnet goes off, the other one comes on, and it pulls the clapper to the other bell, and that goes back and forth, back and forth. Well, the whole concept behind a magnetic eraser is a couple of powerful magnets that go on and off in pulses.
Sure.
So it's exactly the same thing, and he would take it home. Of course, he gets a phone call all the time on his car phone.
That's why you need a car phone, because you're
right.
Important.
That's right. And so he would just erase the CDs, or the floppies, rather, on his way back. Yeah.
And I heard one similar story where the guy was using a magnet to clip it to the file cabinet so he knew where the disk was tomorrow.
There you go.
Doug, does that help you?
A lot.
Yeah, Doug, if you've got an old ringer phone, plug it in, put the discs next to it, and call yourself. You'll be fine.
Well, the trick these days is trying to find a floppy reader. They're getting to be uncommon.
Oh, they are.
Yep.
They are. I've got, I can't tell you how many 3 1/4 inch discs, which I can still read on one of my machines. I've got a bunch of 5 1/4 inch discs that I'm just...
Yeah.
And I've got one 8-inch disc.
I'm too young for the 8 inches. I started with 5 1/4s.
I've got one 8-inch disc. It was probably has some pretty fun stuff on it, but I'll never see it again. It's just sitting there. We at RIT, we teach a class on the history of computers, and so I've got a 3 1/2 and a 5 1/4 and an 8 and a giant reel of IBM memory and of a little matrix of magnetic core memory, and it's just fun stuff.
This is 1K, and this is a trillion K.
Well, yeah, yeah.
When U of R, back in the early 80s, disassembled their IBM 360/70, I remember it was only a few months later that parts started showing up at the local ham fest.
Yeah.
Literally. I used to have programs stored in that very core memory right there.
I was reading an interesting statistic yesterday. They were talking about the history of computers, and there's a company that keeps track of the most powerful machine of every year, and how their deal was that it's like an asymptotic line, it's getting faster and higher and better all over the place. But what I noticed was that the fastest computer in 1993 was, I forget how many gigaflops of speed. And across from it was a system you could buy mounting a rack that was about 3/4 of that many gigaflops per second. And it was like, wait a minute, 1993, this was the most powerful system on Earth, and now it's a commodity item.
Right. Almost bubble pack.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, it's quite astounding to think of how much more, you get a machine that's a couple of years old now. You know, and you think, this is a 1 gigahertz machine? Jeez and crackers, that's
right.
I can get 3 for $500. You know, this was the fastest machine there was.
Right.
In those days. I have still running a quad processor system for 450 megahertz Pentium 2s.
Screaming
wow.
fast.
Wow.
Screaming fast. If you've
got
a
multitasking, that would make a fast system.
No,
if you had a multitasking operating system.
Yeah, I do. I have Linux on it.
There
but
you go.
What it means is that every thread still runs at 450 megahertz. I can just run 4 times as many at once.
Right, right.
So if I've got threaded applications, it gets faster. But no one application really runs any faster. We're going to take another break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 39 minutes after the hour. Sound bites on 1180 WHAM. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Chris Reich.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And at 43 minutes after the hour,
somebody want to tell Steve he's in the wrong
chairs.
Room.
Yeah, Steve, we're all in here. See, he's in there with Rob. If you've got the camera on, you're not seeing him because there he is, and his hand now is in front of the camera. All right, we're back. We've just got, I don't know what, we're having too much something here. Users of Adobe's Creative Suite 3 software complaining that files saved to network files. I'm glad I'm reading this now because Steve's not in the room. Users of Adobe's Creative Suite 3 software are complaining that files saved to network volumes are being corrupted and have linked the problem to their recent update to Mac OS 10.5.3 LeftElbow.j Leopard. Adobe users posting to Apple's discussion boards indicate that files saved from Photoshop InDesign over the network then can't be opened. Some users indicate that downgrading to Mac OS 10.5.2 fixes the issue. Others suggest using Save As to save a copy of a file instead of Save to remedy the issue. Mac OS 10.5.3 was released on Wednesday and reportedly fixes 70 issues with Apple's Leopard operating system. Apple lists changes online, including improvements to security. Clearly, these are now very secure files. Changes to how the operating system software logs into certain network volumes and manages network passwords, and more. Adobe, for its part, told users a year and a half ago not to work on files stored over networks because of potential file corruption. Adobe laid the blame squarely on Apple, saying that Apple has changed Apple Share components in the then-current Mac OS 10.4.6 release. So those of you who are saving Adobe products to a network drive may find corruptions. Now, I don't know if it's only Adobe or they're just the ones who are talking about it, because it would seem to me if it was Apple's problem, it would be every file you saved over a network.
This has been an ongoing problem for years with both Quark and Adobe, because you know programs like Photoshop and Quark Express use such very large files. It's very common for people to store them on a central file server, and it's like every other version or so comes up with some problem about saving to a file server, and the general consensus is copy it to your local hard drive, do your work, and then copy it back to the server, which kind of defeats the purpose of a central file server.
Well, and it also that makes sense in terms of speed.
Yeah.
You know, generally
yeah, working
speaking,
off a server, unless right. you have gigabit Ethernet, which
right,
a lot of
right, right.
you know, it's pretty common now these days.
You're still no faster than the speed of the server at the other end.
Yeah,
and it's doing other things at the same time. I don't know. Is the problem an Adobe problem or is the problem an Apple problem?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of both.
Well, this is interesting because, excuse me, this is the first time I'm hearing about a problem with this. I also upgraded my Macs to 10.5.3 this week, and one of my programs is behaving abnormally in that it's not recording stuff that I have automatically recording, including this show. So I'm wondering now, is this related?
To a server?
Not to a server yet. I'm in the process of building one, but to the local hard drive, yeah. But there are recordings that are not happening that should be and always have been.
There have been some scattered reports of program incompatibility with 10.5.3.
Well, some of my recordings are happening, though, so got me wondering.
Yeah. It's the intermittent problems that are the worst.
Yeah.
Well, I've always said the Apple experience is not perfect.
The whole way of network transmission and breaking everything down into little packets and firing them off independently, and they may end up at the other end along different routes and in different orders.
Right.
That sort of voodoo is just magic the way it works at all.
Yeah, exactly.
So when it doesn't work, why are we surprised?
Well, yeah. That's so true. That is so yep. true. All right. Our next caller is Ginny from Pittsford, New York. Welcome, Ginny. What's your question?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I received a new Dell laptop, and it was wireless. And when I hooked it up and got everything going, I was able to punch in my own password to hook up to my own router. When I try to go to, say, a outside source, and I click on View Available Wireless Networks, it will not work for me. Did I forget to do something?
Is it running Vista or XP?
XP.
So it's not the Vista security bug. There is an issue with unsecure wireless networks. Windows is very hesitant about connecting to an unsecure network. So if you go to a public hotspot, like a coffee shop or something, that will be an unsecure network, and you have to override XP and Vista security saying, yeah, go ahead and connect anyway.
But you should still see it.
Right. Do you not
see it? Isn't there a button that says show?
Right. In the taskbar, there's the Wi-Fi little icon, and if you right-click on that, it says View Wireless Connections.
Right, and that comes up and says Windows cannot view this. I either didn't do something or I skipped a step.
Well, what's the exact error message?
Windows cannot find the viewer list. Something about I'm missing something of, and I went into Dell and I followed all the.
It may not be using the Microsoft wireless manager. It may be using a Dell wireless manager, which would be somewhere else in your menu bars.
Right. There are two ways to manage this stuff, through Windows or through Dell. Ginny, I'm afraid somebody's going to have to sit and actually look at this machine. Oh, because this is not one we're going to be able to solve.
Make sure that the wireless button is turned on. A lot of laptops have a button on the front to turn wireless off to save battery life. Make sure that's on and your wireless is working.
Sorry, Ginny. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, McFrancesco, and you. 49 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, 1180 WHAM. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesca.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Reich.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And at 54 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. All right, kiddies. Normally, this is that time when we would have Uncle Dave's rant. Uncle Dave is not here, but even so.
I've got sort of a rant. I was guessing he would have, too.
Yeah, even so. Grab your footy jammies, your mug of hot cocoa, sit Indian style around the rocking chair. Because even though we enjoy slapping him, it's story hour with Uncle Steve. Uncle Steve? Uncle Steve!
Thank you.
More appropriate.
As many of you might have remembered, last weekend was a holiday weekend.
Yes, yes it was.
And in sort of an unprecedented move, we were closed for the holiday weekend.
Yeah.
The whole weekend?
Well, Sunday and Monday.
All right.
So people who dropped
That's the first time since what, 1932?
Something like that. So people who dropped their computer off Thursday or Friday, you know, especially Friday afternoon, called up Tuesday morning, is it done yet? Well, no. Well, you've had it for 4 days. Okay, we've had it for about a half a business hour.
Yeah.
Because you dropped it off late Friday afternoon. It was a holiday. We were closed. We deserve some time off now. I know your computer's important, and so are the 20 other people ahead of you's computers. They're important to them, too.
Well, they forget that we are human. We need to rest. See, we have families.
We have to stop acting like superheroes online.
Exactly. Exactly. Somebody was very upset with me the other day that I hadn't done something. And I said, you asked me at midnight, and it's now 9 a.m. I slept in between that.
Good for you.
Yeah, I did.
Our record is just under an hour. Someone dropped their computer off, you know, one night, you know, just after 6, called at 9 in the next morning as soon as we opened. Is it done yet? Well, no, you only brought it in last night at 6. Well, record, yeah, but you're open till 7.
Yeah. The record for calls, not for fixing a machine.
Right,
you
right,
need
right,
to
record,
let everybody understand
record
that.
Record for calls to see if their computer is done yet is just
otherwise,
about
50. People are going to start calling saying, well, you did the last guy in an hour.
Yeah. Well, and Dave runs into the same problem because people ask us, how long do you think it's going to take to fix and how much do you think the bill is going to be? A couple of hours of billable time. So they call back in a couple hours.
Yeah, see, you need to be more
right.
careful about
we'll
that.
We'll get to it in a few days.
Right. It's going to take a couple of days for us to deal with it.
Because there's 20 people ahead of you in line.
I will charge you more than a few hours.
Yeah.
You should do the Scotty of Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, you double your estimate.
You didn't tell them, how long it would
tell them you'll
take,
have it in 10 days, and then you look like a hero when you have it in 5 days.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right, but the reality is we all have that problem. You know, the fact is that people, things take time.
The other one I love is it's been broken for a year. But I haven't gotten a chance to get it into you.
Or wait till September.
Yep.
My son's computer has been broken all summer, and he just told me he needs it to take back
and
with him tomorrow.
He's leaving for school tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That wasn't so much a rant as it wasn't quite an Uncle Dave rant, so we're lucky this year. I barely finished my hot cocoa. We're going to take a break. Coming up now will be the news, the weather, the sports, all the very important things you listen to Wham for. And on the other side of that, we will be back with Steve Ray, with Chris Reich, with the mighty Rob Linton, with me, Nick Francesco. It is 57 minutes after the hour, and you are all listening to the greatest computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites. This is 1180 WHAM.
Hello.
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 Hello. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Reich.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And it's 7 minutes after the hour on the 1st of June, odd 8. You are listening to Soundbites. It's June already.
Did you say 1th?
The 1st of June, odd 8. Thank you. You got a problem with that? Now, normally, this is where we talk about the poll and what goes on the website. But before we do that, I want to stop the show, make a personal, public thanks to my favorite wife, Elaine. One of the many reasons I married her, she does not want to go see Sex in the City. I am very excited about this. She would much rather go see a good Jackie Chan movie with me than sit through Sex in the City, and I couldn't be more appreciative. So many thanks to my bride, Elaine. That's wonderful.
She is a wonderful lady.
She is. She is.
So who's your least favorite wife?
My favorite wife is a Cary Grant movie. Yeah. It's the title of a Cary Grant movie. One time years ago when I worked help desk for a living, my friend Jill called me. And Jill and I were doing a show, and she was playing my wife in the show. So she calls and she says, "I need to speak to Nick. This is Jill." And the woman who took the message said, "I'm afraid he's not here, but I'll tell him his wife called." And she said, "No." I said, "I'll tell him you called. Is this his wife?" She said, "No, it's his other wife."
Yeah.
She almost didn't give me the message. And I think I made a horrible mistake. No, it's just Jill and her sense of humor. We're doing a show, blah, blah, blah. All right. Microsoft is finally opening up about when Windows 7 will ship, but the company continues to share just a few tantalizing details of the theoretically eagerly anticipated operating system update. The latest tidbit to drop is a multi-touch interface support. At the Wall Street Journal's D conference on Tuesday evening, company founder and chief software architect Bill Gates and chief executive Steve Ballmer will be scheduled, that's this coming Tuesday, will be scheduled to unveil a laptop with a touchscreen that accepts multiple simultaneous touches. The effect is quite reminiscent of what's possible with the world's most popular commercially available gesture-based interface device, the iPhone. Officially, Windows 7 is scheduled to ship 3 years after the general availability of Windows Vista. Vista's business editions launched on March 30th, 2006, which means the software could ship as early as that date in 2009, with a beta release in advance. Vista's editions for the home market launched January 29th, 2007. To be fair, this is not Microsoft's first foray into multi-touch arena. They have their innovative Surface computing platform, which combines cameras to sense the gestures and touches of a single or multiple users, allowing them to interact with a tabletop full of digital objects. Microsoft would not say specifically whether the OS will support gestures, as well as the much multi-touch interface support, rather, like Surface does. Given the gesture support in Apple's products, however, something similar is likely. A spokes individual for Microsoft said the company is working closely with OEMs, IHVs, and ISVs, whatever those all are, independent hardware vendors, independent software vendors, to bring the best touch experiences to the Windows PC. Touch is quickly becoming a common way of directly interacting with software and devices. Touch-enabled devices are popping up everywhere, including laptop, touchpads, cell phones, remote controls, GPS devices, and more.
Touchscreens are expensive, though, and I can't see cheap Windows PCs getting too many touchscreens.
Well, they're expensive now. Maybe right. They won't be when they become commodity items.
Yeah, that's the whole, they have to be big enough to until they're not expensive anymore.
Even so, unless that laptop is a tablet, or if you're going to put it on a desktop, you will spend all your time with your hands waving around in the air in front of you. For most people, that will be tiring after a while.
Absolutely.
It also disenfranchises yet another segment of America, those people who do not have as great control over their motor movements as the rest of us do. Yep. So, but at any rate, as you know, every week on our website at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like to remind you, we do a poll. Last week's poll. Excuse me, I beg your pardon. Last week's poll was about the Trillion bug, and the question was, I used the Trillion IM client. 245 of you voted, making it number 293 on the all-time hit list, thanks to each and every one of you. 69% of you don't want to talk to anybody. 25% of you use a different IM client. 3% of you said, yes, they use it, and it's patched. And, of course, 7 of you said, yes, and I'm going commando, baby. This week's poll is about the article I just read, and the question is Windows 7's touchscreen interface. The choices are can't wait, I'll wait for version 2, and wait, what? So far, approximately 78 of you have voted. Number one choice so far, of course, is wait, what? Followed by I'll wait for version 2, and only 5 of you can't wait. Now,
already using a multi-touch interface on my Mac.
Are you?
Well, their trackpad has multi-touch features built into it. 2 fingers do things, 3 fingers do things.
Right, right, right.
You can rotate images just by spinning your fingers on the trackpad.
Right.
And then the iPhone has its touch interface also.
But Microsoft is talking about doing it and as a touch screen. And certainly if it's a tablet, that's doable. But again, if I have to spend all day with my hands... And I don't want people I already don't want people touching my screen. I don't touch my screen.
We get some filthy computers into the shop.
Holy
I don't want to touch them sometimes.
You know, people eat lunch at their desks, and I don't want to be in the middle of a jelly sandwich and have to touch the screen in some way. It's just, it's grody enough with your mouse. I dip mine in alcohol every day. I dip something in alcohol every day. I think it's my mouse.
We've started stocking, I forget who makes it, if it's Kensington or Kingston. Somebody makes a
skin?
Germ-resistant mouse with a bacterial agent in it.
That's a good idea.
An antibacterial agent. Thank you.
Yes. Got a bacterial agent in it. I don't need that. I can send my own in there.
Yeah. But I got a real kick out of the Windows Supersite blog when he was blogging at the D conference, and Microsoft reveals nothing about Windows 7. Read all about it.
Yeah.
Microsoft, that wasn't news, this touchscreen interface.
Microsoft talks Windows 7, but doesn't say anything.
Well, right. It's all about the hype. The problem right now is the Mac and Linux in particular are getting a lot of hype right now. And Microsoft doesn't like that. And they got nothing to talk about. So they're talking about things that may or may not actually appear in the next version of the operating system. They do that all the time. Look at all the stuff they talked about. I'm still waiting for the database-based file system, which they promised us, at least 2 releases of Windows ago. And we still haven't seen it.
That out. I still like the video somebody put together when Bill Gates was announcing a lot of the cool new features in Vista. They overlaid it with shots of the Macintosh already doing that.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
That's the joke, is that Microsoft has to wait until Apple comes out with something new to copy it.
Yes, they do.
Well, here's the thing. And if they have the touchscreen interface, what's the big deal if you're going to touch it and get another blue screen to death? I have an idea. How about making an operating system that isn't broken in the first place?
Now, there is an innovative operating system.
I already have that.
It's called Mac OS X and Linux.
And
pretty
Unix,
much any version.
BSD, Open Solaris.
Right, right.
The list continues.
Every operating system has its problems. The reason that I like to use Linux, and in my case Ubuntu, is because I've got 100,000 programs at my fingertips that are all insanely useful and totally free. And updates happen all the time. It tells me there's an update, and unless it's a really, really, really serious update, I don't have to reboot.
Right.
I don't have to reboot, and I have to admit it, I'm pleased that every time I get an update, it's not for iTunes. I don't want Safari. I don't want it.
They did split that out now, so it's
yeah, sort of.
Here's updates to stuff you have, and here's some new stuff you might like.
Yeah, and you have to unclick it every time.
Yeah,
there's no
ignore in the future.
At least not. I certainly haven't seen it.
I'll have to try that on mine. I did break down and put Windows VM on my laptop.
I've got Windows VM on this thing.
Yep,
it's kind of fun to run a Windows system inside your Linux box.
But there's just something wrong about seeing that Microsoft logo on a Mac.
If you really want Windows.
If you really want Windows, that's the way to run it. If it blue screens, you just shut it down.
Yeah.
Not a big deal. We're virtualizing all of our servers in the E. Philip Saunders College of Business at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And what we're doing with them is putting them all on a big virtual server. So everyone has their own little session. And that way, we can put up a lot more of them, you know, for testing or whatever we want to do. And they cannot interfere with running production things. And it also means that when something dies, we can have a snapshot from an hour ago that we can bring back if we want to. Or obviously, we can just rebuild it from scratch.
And when something dies, it's the process that dies, not the server.
Right.
Great.
Right. Well, it's that individual instance of Windows.
Right.
Right. So I can have 5 instances of Windows running. If one dies for some reason, the other 4 keep running.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Right. So, yeah, it's for that, it's really nice. And now, higher-end desktop machines can do that as well. In fact, my machine at home is doing that. I run, and this laptop is doing it, for Pete's sake. I run two different, on a laptop, I don't run them simultaneously, but I run two different versions of, two different virtual sessions of Windows, one XP and one Vista. So when people call me with a computer question, I don't have to say it's somewhere in the something menu. There's a choice, something.
Yeah.
I can say, oh, yeah, it's click. I can get to it and make it happen. And if I do that, and if whatever I do screws up my machine, which happens really kind of more often than not, I just shut the session down and start it back up again. And as long as I haven't written anything out to the hard drive, I haven't in any way done anything to the system.
And no rebootage, no lost time.
The system, it still takes, well, it not for the operating, for the base operating system, for my Linux box.
Right.
I have to reboot Windows, and that takes forever. But once it's running, it runs everything. I can do, you know, whatever I need to do. Obviously, some things are a little slow. Like, I wouldn't run Second Life on my Windows box as a virtual machine inside Linux because it runs so much faster with just the Linux client. But I can do it. I just wouldn't. You know, it would be slow. But virtualization is happening more and more and more. And I also like it in that I can do a lot of testing. You know, you can virtualize Windows inside Windows. So if you want to test something, you just bring up the virtual system. And it boots in a window, and it's an entirely separate instance of Windows running inside a window in Windows, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around. But that leaves me with the freedom to, this might, you know, is this a virus? Is there something bad here? I can test it. I can check it out. I can, you know, try new software that might change DLLs or whatever it all is. And it doesn't matter. I don't have to worry about it because I just shut it down. If I feel that I've somehow gotten a virus, I just wipe out the entire file on the hard drive and restart it from a new one again.
I'll be doing something very similar to that very soon on my iMac. I'll be, I have an Intel iMac, so I'll be putting VMware on it. I bought from Steve's shop, and I expect to be supporting a good friend of mine coming into town, returning to town for, I'll be putting Ubuntu on his laptop.
There you go.
And I no longer have a machine that will run just Ubuntu, so I'll virtualize it on my iMac so that when he has a problem, I'll look at it and see what I can help him with.
Yeah, on my MacBook Pro, I am virtualizing Ubuntu and both versions of Windows. Again, not simultaneously, but I can do it. And at home, I can run both versions of Windows simultaneously. Not yet the Mac, although SciStar says they're doing that.
Well, yeah, and that's the big question is how long is Apple going to let them do that before they sue them? But technically,
buy it now. Buy the SciStar now, and it'll become a collector's item.
Well, see, technically, SciStar's not violating the license. Because the license says that...
Well, wait, let's talk about that after the break.
Okay.
We do have to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 20 minutes after the hour. We are Sound Bites. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Reich.
And I'm Rob Linton. I always like to say it's so nice to be here at the home.
You know, lunch. When they leave us here with no adult supervision,
this gets out of control. Absolutely out of control, but that's not right.
They deserve it. We were talking about SciStar, but let's take a call first. We have Dave on a cell phone. Dave, welcome. What's your question?
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. I'm trying to do some writing using Windows, an e-machine Word program.
Yeah?
And how do I find the spell check? I have Windows XP on there.
What Word other tools?
Well, what word processor are you using to you're typing with?
It's an e-machine.
Right. What program do you open to
Windows
start?
Windows XP.
That's the operating system. What program do you use? Microsoft Word, Microsoft Write?
I think I have Microsoft Word, sir.
In the tools menu, there's a spelling command. In one of your toolbars, you may find a checkbox, a check mark that will check your spelling. And if it's a later version of Word in the last 2 or 3 years, it automatically spell checks as you type. So something will have a red squiggly underline, that means it's misspelled.
Right.
And if
it's about 3 or 4 years old. So
yeah, there also was a version.
Go up to the toolbar and hit tools.
Yeah.
Well, in the menu bar, there should be a tools menu, and one of the tools is spelling and grammar.
Okay. May I ask you another question?
Sure.
I listen to your program. I have no idea what you're talking about most of the time.
That's why we do this show.
Yeah, we don't either.
We figure you guys are asking the questions. You're not going to know the answers. We can say anything we want.
That's exciting. Got room in the home for another indigent. But how does one learn to use a lot of these things? Trial and error takes so much time.
Well, trial and error does work, but it is very difficult.
And it's the most effective tool to teach.
Right. One of the best things you can do is to join a local users group. Where are you calling from?
Right in Rochester.
Then you have access to both Apple Cider. Well, Apple Cider is the, this is general for everybody. Apple Cider is the local Apple users group at applecider.org. Lugor is the local Linux users group at lugor.org. And the Rochester Computer Society is the local PC users group, and I don't remember where they are. Rochester, hold on, I'll get there in a second.
RCS.org.
RCSI.org, I think it is.
Now, let me ask you a question, please. You're all this talk about switching to the Linux system.
Yeah.
Does that completely mean you completely remove everything out of your Windows and switch to Linux?
You can, certainly.
But
not necessary.
But you don't have to.
Yeah, you can run them both at the same time. Or one,
yeah, you switch
one, or one at a time, yeah.
Yeah, well, you can do...
So we go to www.lugor.com.
.org. O-R-G.
Okay, so tell me again, L-U?
L-U-G-O-R.org.
That's Linux Users Group of Rochester. That's
L-U-G-O-R,
what Lugor.
Lugor.
Now I understand.
And then the Windows-based group is the Rochester Computer Society, rcsi.org.
Okay, and then you get right online and talk to people.
And then the Macintosh group is applecider.org.
Now, all of these groups have not only forums and stuff where you can talk to people, but they also have meetings once a month where you can go and talk to people. Ask your questions. They'll show you stuff. They have demonstrations every month. A couple of them have new user groups and special interest groups, if you like, if you're interested in graphics or whatever. So it's all available to you. In fact, the Rochester Computer Society does, I believe, have a Linux support group for people who are brand new to Linux.
Yes, they do.
And
they don't have their June meeting on
Can I ask you one more question?
The second Tuesday of the month.
One more question, and that's it.
Yes, sir. On Google, they have a program that you can pinpoint any place in the world and then get a 3D representation.
Yes.
What do you call that?
Maps.
Google Earth.
Okay. Google Earth.
Well, yeah, Google Maps or Google Earth?
Right.
Google Maps are online. You get to it through your browser.
Please listen to what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, there's, in Flushing Meadows, there's the Unisphere sculpture.
Yeah.
And I can get that location and bring it up, but I can never get it to come up in 3D.
It won't come up in 3D.
It's Earth. Google Earth will do it.
Google Maps does satellite photos and aerial photos. And on Google Earth, which is a program you download to your own computer, people have created models of certain objects, so that you can see a 3D model of different objects on Google Earth, but not on every object, only in the larger cities. So
if someone has created a 3D model of that structure and uploaded it to Google Earth, when you run Google Earth on your computer, you would see it in 3D. But otherwise, you would not.
Normally, you just get satellite photos or you get aerial photography. In some of the larger cities, there's a street view where they actually had a van driving down the street taking pictures. So you can see pictures of streets and people on the streets. And there's lawsuits going on about that.
I followed that van. There must be a shot of my car somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
In Google Earth. All right. Thank you very much, Dave.
It's not real time. You know, the big question is how old are the photos? And in many cases, you know, right. A couple of years old. But it does give you a pretty good idea of something.
Right.
Now, there is a real time. What's the name of it? The electroscope. There's a real time sort of art exhibit now running. They have a how big was it? Like a 8 or 10 foot screen. In New York and London with real-time communication between the two. So you can see people in real time across the Atlantic.
Nice.
And it sort of started as a joke project. Not a joke project, but a project,
novelty?
Novelty, thank you. In the late 1800s where they were going to dig a tunnel, and with mirrors and whatnot, you could see what was happening.
How cool is that?
So they actually completed that, and when you go there, part of the history of this thing is the way the tunnel works. But it actually uses, you know, the undersea internet cable, so it's just two computers hooked on the internet. But it's really cool seeing live real time people, and they say they hooked it up and it was noon in London, which was like 5 a.m. in New York, and
right.
They saw an empty street and okay, wow.
Not in New York, they didn't.
Well,
even at 5 a.m. they didn't.
So then someone.
I lived in New York and I was up at 5 a.m.
Somebody walked by and waved at it. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. All right, our next caller is Judy from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Judy. What's your question?
Hi, I have, I just bought a new laptop, a Dell, and it has Microsoft Vista on it,
yeah.
Which I can't stand to use.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, can I remove that and put an XP disk in it?
Yes and no.
It depends. Well, you can put it in if you want it to work or not. That's the next question.
Yeah, right. There's several things that work here. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. First, you have to buy a new copy of XP. You can't just use a disk from some other machine. Secondly, you would have to wipe out Vista entirely in order to do that. Third, if you didn't buy the XP disk from Dell, you might not get all the drivers necessary to run your new laptop correctly.
All right. So if I get it from Dell, can I install the drivers too, or do I have to have someone do
it? If you get the CD from Dell, you call Dell and you say, this is my serial number, and I want a copy of XP that runs this laptop, they will sell you that.
Okay.
They will try to talk you out of it, but they will sell it to you if you're persistent enough.
And I can't stand that Vista.
Well, welcome to the club. There's about a million of us who can't stand it.
Ubuntu is spelled UBUNTU.com.
Okay. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. We get that a lot. I get that question a lot at Ask Nick. At AskNick.com.
Now, does she have a...
That's...
Oh, sorry.
AskNick.com.
A mean, vicious, nasty, no-good, baggy-eyed, marble-headed ignoramus.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Pretty
I
much
almost
sums
disappointed
it up.
You. How long you've been prepping that, and I almost didn't go there. At Ask Nick, I often get that very same question, and what do you say to people? I agree. Vista stinks on ice. I can't help it.
Now, is Judy on borrowed time? Does she have only until the 30th of the month to get XP?
Well, I would hurry. That's a good question, and I don't have a real answer for that. Theoretically, yes, you only have till the end of the month to be able to buy a copy of XP for a new machine.
The problem is that there's several different layers involved. You have the retail Windows you'd buy in a store. You have the OEM Windows that system builders can buy.
Right.
And what Microsoft has said is that the, what do they call it, Windows Starter Pack for the under $400 computers.
Right.
Windows XP, they will still keep selling to OEMs for those types of computers.
Right. Because if I'm going to buy a computer for under $400, the first thing I want to do is slow it down with Windows.
Right.
Exactly.
Especially Vista, yeah.
Exactly.
So it is getting harder.
That's what I meant.
And it's possible Microsoft could extend it again, because originally it was December 31st of last year, and they extended it another 6 months.
To the end of this month.
Till the end of this month, they'll continue to sell retail copies and OEM copies of XP.
Right.
But it's a catch-22 that XP is a five-year-old operating system. You should want something newer, but Vista requires so much more hardware to run well, and it doesn't work with all your old peripherals. And that's the joke. If your printer doesn't work, buy a new printer.
Right. And if you bought a system on a budget, you likely don't have enough oomph to run Vista well.
Yeah, decent Vista machine is going to push $1,000.
Easily. And if you're going to run it on a lesser machine, you run it in classic mode, which makes it XP. So why am I paying for Vista? All right. Yeah. Our next caller is Bill from Greece, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to make some music CDs. I need some recommendations on software. And I've tried Nero 7, Total Recorder, Audacity, and Media Monkey, and I'm not really happy with any of those. Can you recommend anything that's simpler?
Are you looking for a recording program or an editing program or an authoring program?
I have some CDs that has music on it. Now I'm going to rip the songs off of those and make my own CD.
For backup purposes only, of course.
Right.
Well, just so I play it.
For backup purposes only, of course,
yeah.
Right?
Say yes.
That's the only way we can help you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep, you got it.
That's a fourth class of program called a jukebox program.
Mm-hmm.
And programs like Microsoft Media Player, Apple's iTunes, Winamp.
Are you having problem ripping, or are you having problem recording back to the CD?
Let's say they don't make it easy to do. I want something simple.
iTunes makes it very easy to rip your CDs in, create new playlists of your favorite songs, and burn a new CD of those songs.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, let's start a little more fundamental question. You said an audio CD. Do you actually mean a CD to play in an audio player, or do you want to make an MP3 disc?
No, audio player.
Okay, you're making
an
audio.
Like a car radio.
And you're simply trying to duplicate songs that you already have on commercially purchased CDs.
Correct.
Okay, and your operating system is?
XP.
XP.
Certainly iTunes would do that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, iTunes might be an ideal way to do that.
Okay, iTunes, you don't have to buy the music from them then.
You don't have to.
No, not at all.
In fact, iTunes has existed for years before they had the iTunes store.
Right. When you run iTunes, if you put in a CD, the first thing iTunes will do, whether you want it to or not, is try to rip that CD.
No, that's a preference you have to turn on.
Well,
it asks you if you want to, yeah. And then it rips it into the computer, and then you can play it on your computer without needing the CD anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can then make a playlist of your favorite songs from many different CDs and burn that back to a new blank CD, so you have all your favorite songs on one CD. That was the original purpose of iTunes, because people complained that, you know, 9 out of 10 of the songs that come on a CD are crap, and so I just want my favorite ones.
Right, that's what I want to do.
Yep.
Okay. And also what I have is I put most of my CDs I have now on a USB hard drive. I can still be able to get them off of there. I don't have to re-put them like on.
Well, you should be able to attach that drive to your system.
Yeah.
And then tell iTunes to import all of those.
Okay.
Those songs, right.
But those will now then be doubled, right? They'll be on his hard drive.
You can tell iTunes to copy into the library, or you can tell iTunes to leave them where they are and just use them from there.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, right.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
We're going to take another break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 39 minutes after the hour. Soundbites, 1180 WHAM. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Reich.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. We're going to go right to the phones. Our next caller is Nick from Greece, New York. Welcome, Nick. What's your question? Nick? Are you there? Hello, Nick.
His name is Dick.
His name is Dick.
Okay. I'm trying to use the
Tango. I apologize. I see
my neighbor.
My name everywhere.
I thought maybe my neighbor was calling. I've been trying to use Tango, and I'm getting a statement for both SpyBot. I've tried to update them, I guess. SpyBot and Stinger saying, and it's not... Exec.exe is not a valid Win32 application. And the same thing for Stinger. And I guess I don't know what to do about it.
Well, that sounds like a bad download.
Well, I've gone to Service Pack 3 on Windows. I thought I was up to date on everything.
That may be it. Service Pack 3 broke other things.
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure the sequence. I don't think I had Service Pack 3 when I first downloaded them. I'm on dial-up, so it takes a long time, to
download some of this stuff.
And it's very easy to get a corrupted download on dial-up.
Oh, really? Yeah.
You're on dial-up?
Yeah.
That may very well be the problem. One of the things you can do is buy the CD from Dave Enright.
I know, for the $5.
He's got the latest stuff on there. And
and he collects it all and makes sure it's the latest versions of everything and one-offs the disc, basically.
Yeah, every disc is pretty much unique.
Well, maybe I should do that then, yeah.
That might be best. Dial-up, it's very hard to download large and complex programs.
Well,
like
I know. It's a couple hours for one of these service pack 3, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you talk about VHS recording will disappear when we go to HDTV, or is this too far afield? I don't know what to do if I want to record programs on HDTV. From HDTV.
It's the same thing you do now. You need a recording device. You can use a VHS tape player if you have a digital tuner or if you're using cable TV.
Oh, really?
The VHS records the same signal you see on your screen.
Oh.
So if you're not actually seeing HD, then it will record it fine. I don't know if it'll record HD well, because I don't know that it's got the bandwidth.
Well, your analog out wouldn't have an HD compliant anyway, yeah. You can also get a DVD recorder that records directly onto a DVD disc instead of a VHS tape.
Well, that's what I wondered, but I haven't seen many of them around. I guess maybe I would look hard enough.
Yeah, they're in all the stores. They start about $100, depending on you want just the recorder and you use your existing cable box, or if you want a tuner in the box as well, so that you can record one channel while you're watching a different channel. You need multiple tuners for that. Mm-hmm. So basically, the way most VCRs work now is there's a cable box in the VCR that has its own tuner, so you can record a channel on your VCR while you're watching a different channel on your television, because it has its own tuner built in. And we'll see the same sort of things happen through the digital transition. The big thing that's going to stop next year is analog broadcast television. So if you're using just rabbit ears now, you'll need to get a new digital tuner for your TV and or your VCR.
Which aren't terribly expensive.
They're about $50. And
you get a $40
rebate. There's a $40 coupon you get ahead of time.
Coupon, right.
It's DTV.gov. We've had links in our link list. So you can get this $40 coupon, and then you can go to places like Best Buy and Circuit City and Walmart, all the electronic stores, and buy a digital tuner, and then use it on your old analog VCR to get the digital television stations. The quality will be less than the digital television signal, because you're recording on an analog television. And this will happen February 17th, 2009. So it's DTV2009.gov to get the coupons. DTV.gov has more information on the digital transition. So if you're using cable now, either digital cable or analog cable, you don't have to do anything. It's only if you're using rabbit ears. So that fourth TV in the basement, maybe.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okie doke.
Yep.
I've got an antenna. An outside antenna here in Greece, South Greece.
And so you will need the tuner box.
A new digital tuner starting February next year. In fact, you can get the digital tuners now, and you get really great quality television. Even on your standard definition televisions, because of the quality of the signal we're getting from the digital channels. Yeah, so if you are using an antenna now, you will need a new digital tuner box after February of next year, but you can get them now, too.
And then your VHS recorder will be able to record that signal off the tuner box stick.
Right. All right, we're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Chris Reich, Rob Linton, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 49 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Chris Wright.
And I'm Rob Linton.
And at 53 minutes after the hour, we're Soundbites. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Robert from Spencerport. Welcome, Robert. What's your question? Robert?
Austin.
Dick? Fred? What am I doing wrong here?
You're not doing anything. Keep
All right,
going.
Our next caller is Steve from Greece. Welcome, Steve. What's your question?
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Recently, we had a problem with our printer, so we uninstalled the software and reinstalled it, and that worked out okay. Except my only question is now, is when I right-click on the printer icon on the taskbar, the lower right, if I'm calling it the correct thing, Now we have HP DeskJet 5700 series, copy one, copy two, and then it's also listed a third time.
You want to go into your control panel. So from the start menu, go to settings, go to control panels, and then under printers, you can delete those printers you don't have anymore. So that's the print queue that's that was created for that printer.
I think I tried that, and it does not work. It's just not that simple.
What happens when you try?
You can highlight them and
right click on it and choose delete, or highlight it, go to the file menu and choose delete.
I'll try it again, but okay, this is the
you have to be the administrator of the system to do that.
Well, I mean I'm the owner of the computer, but how do I?
Well, if you're the owner, you're the administrator.
Probably the account you created likely must be an administrator account. What operating system are you in?
XP.
Yeah, so the first account you create is the administrator.
All right, so it's settings, control, and then control panel.
And then printers. And then right-click on the print queue and choose delete. And that should delete that print queue so that you can ignore it and not see it in your menus anymore.
Okie doke. Our next caller, Mike, from Gates, New York. Welcome, Mike. What's your question?
Real quick, my wife is trying to use my computer, and she made my address bar go away on my Microsoft Internet Explorer, and I can't get it back.
Under the View menu, you can choose which toolbars and which address bars you want enabled. So yeah. You have different toolbars, and you have different Explorer bars. Do you know if it's IE 5, 6 or 7?
I think it's 7.
Yeah, so under the View menu, there's a toolbar to show your menu bar and show your links.
Well, yeah, and over to standard buttons, I've got that checked. Address bar, I've got that checked. Links, I've got that checked. And lock the toolbars, I have that checked. But I still don't have an address bar.
It's probably off to the side then. Uncheck, lock the address bar or lock the toolbar, and then you may be able to drag around off to the side and find where that address bar got moved to.
Generally, once you unlock it, to the left of the toolbars is a little, it's a little
thing,
holder thing that comes up, and you should be able to click on that and drag the bars around. It may be behind something, it may be pushed off to the side by something, so you can stack them in a different order by pulling that little handle up and down. When you unlock it, you will see the handle appear on the left side of the toolbars that are movable, so it's pretty obvious what it is. So give that a try. I think we've got time for a call from Ed from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Ed. What's your question?
Thanks a lot. Yeah, just real quick. Do you think on a basic entry-level type computer, you're not going to do any stuff on that the 2-gig memory and 160-gig hard drive is sufficient? It's on Windows XP.
Yes. 2 gig is enough for even Vista.
The minimum for Vista.
Yeah, right. And 160-gig hard drive, particularly if you're not doing high-end graphics or audio, will last you a very, very long time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's one of the things that we find a lot with new machines. People tend to not have any idea what is reasonable size for things. For example, you know, you can buy the new solid-state hard drive, 64 gig. That, when you can buy 160-gig hard drive, 64 doesn't sound like a lot. But again, if all you're doing is text or all you're doing is email or all you're doing, well, email, somebody sends you, you know, a 10-gig
picture. Yeah.
But if you're doing email that, like at Google or whatever, and you're doing where they store it for you, you can get an awful lot of stuff on a 64-gig partition, so a 64-gig solid-state drive. So,
and that happens a lot. Oh, I'm not going to use my computer for much until you realize, oh, digital pictures and digital video, and then suddenly your hard drive is full.
Well, right.
Then you go get an external.
Then you get another one.
Well, yep. And that's the thing. If you know, everybody says, well, I'm not going to do much except look at pictures of my grandkids that my family sends me all day, every day. Well, that requires a lot of storage. That's the way that works. All right, I'm afraid we are done for another week. I want to thank each and every one of you who called in. Thank you so very much. I want to apologize to those of you to whom I did not get. Please call in earlier next week. We'll be able to get to everybody. That way we get a bucket load of calls at the end of the show and fewer at the beginning. So that's what happens there. I want to thank Steve Ray, always Chris Reich, who comes in no matter how he's feeling and does a magnificent job of helping us out. Rob Linton, who was here whether he knew it or not. I'm Nick Francesco, 59 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, 1180 WHAM.